Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with the Reverend Dr. Elaine Heath, who is an assistant professor of evangelism at the Perkins School of Theology and the director of the Center for the Advanced Study and Practice of Evangelism at Southern Methodist University. She's an elder in the East Ohio Conference of the United Methodist Church, and her newest book is called The Mystic Way of Evangelism, A Contemplative Vision for Christian Outreach. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you.
Well, Elaine, for me, when I saw the title of your book, I was confused because the words mystic and evangelism don't really go together in my head.
Yes.
You know, I have visions of television preachers thumping their Bibles at me, and they don't seem very mystical.
Oh.
So can you tell us what you mean by that?
By mystical or by evangelism?
By the mystic way of evangelism.
Okay. I am thinking about evangelism through a lens of Christian spirituality. That's how I approach it. And I have titled this book The Mystic Way of Evangelism because my thesis of the book is that the church in the United States is moving into a dark night of the soul.
Mm.
And the best place to go when you're in a dark night of the soul is to saints and mystics who've been there, and they make the best guides for us. So my proposal is that the great Christian mystics of the church are the ones who can guide us through the night and can help us understand, again, what real evangelism means, because I believe their lives and their writings are deeply evangelistic.
So I want to ask you a couple questions based on what you just said. The first is, can you say a little more about the dark night of the soul and how you see the church being in a dark night of the soul?
Sure. In the sort of classically understood contemplative way, a dark night of the soul is a process that God actually initiates in order to help free us from our disordered affections, our attachments to things that have become actually idolatrous in our lives. And different people have used different language to talk about the dark night of the soul. I think sometimes that's a phrase that is misused and misunderstood. St. John of the Cross wrote a book about the dark night of the soul. It's a mystical text. But really what happens in if you look at it from a person's standpoint and an individual standpoint, it's a time of liminality, of a shift. It's moving into a time where the things that you thought you knew about God and all of your certainties are shaken up, and you're taken into a place of uncertainty and something that Evelyn Underhill called de-selfing.
Huh.
And then as you move through this time, if we can move through the time and allow the night to do its work and allow God never stops loving us and never stops holding us through these times, but sometimes we experience a dark night as if God had disappeared or God had gone on vacation or something, or we don't feel God the way we did before. But it can loosen us from our attachments, especially our idolatrous attachments to religious forms and activities and rigid ways of thinking, that sort of thing. So usually the phrase the dark night of the soul or the concept is applied to individuals, but I believe that it's also appropriate to apply to corporate personalities. I think it's definitely appropriate to apply to the church. And when you look at some of the symptoms, so to speak, of a dark night, I see those symptoms happening in the church in the United States. And so, for example, we're moving into a time of great spiritual dryness. Lots of people feel like they believe in God, but they can't connect with the church. The church feels increasingly irrelevant to them. They believe in Jesus. They're spiritual. They're interested in having community with some like-minded believers, but they feel just kind of flat about what they've experienced as church in the past. There's an increased fruitlessness when you go through the night. Things that used to be fruitful don't produce fruit now.
Huh.
In my book, I talk about how in the past we did all these sorts of Sunday school bus campaigns and, you know, sort of revivals and oh, if we put a new bell tower on the church, it'll attract new people to the church. And so we're sort of in this frenzied activity, and it's not producing the fruit. We're seeing a lot of decline numerically in church attendance and church membership, and
yeah.
also in church finances. So there are a number of these signs of an impending night, and a lot of them have to do with, in the church, how we've put our faith in money, we've put our faith in buildings, we've put our faith in programs and charismatic leaders, and thought that that was how we were going to advance the kingdom of God somehow. And those are the things that are being shaken now.
Wow, that's great. That's really interesting. I want you to talk a little more now about how mystic spirituality can kind of help address this. You know, how is that a solution or a help to those of us who are in that dark night of the soul? Or to the church, as the church.
Okay, the first thing is that to understand that when we go into a dark night, it's something that God wants to use to heal us. When we have disordered affections, when we have these attachments to things, that doesn't help us. That's not a good thing in our lives.
Right.
Think about any kind of substance abuse, you know, or any kind of addiction. That's not a good thing in our lives. And so God is actually working through this to bring about liberation and healing for us. What we really have to come back to, and this is what the night will produce in us, is coming back to, what is God's actual meaning? Well, God's meaning is love. And the mystics help us to see this. I especially highlight Julian of Norwich for that theme. That's sort of the grounding theme of my book. We have to come back to the fact that love is God's meaning. Judgment is not God's meaning. Money is not God's meaning. And a number of other things that have usurped God's place in our hearts and our religious hearts. So coming back to this grounding in the love of God, and that's going to involve rethinking some of our theological foundations. It's going to involve coming home to God's love for us as individuals and then being healed of our false self and living out of our true self. It's going to involve reconnecting with God's love for the whole world, not just humans, but this world that God created. In the New Testament, in John, when it talks about God's love for the world, in several places the Greek word is cosmos. It's not just people, it's cosmos. So there's this beautiful holistic quality to coming home to God's love. Those are some of the things that the mystic way helps us to do.
And how do you see churches making the shift? Because I feel like churches are sometimes just, you know, rearranging chairs on the Titanic. They're just doing more of the same to try to get people in the doors, and it's incredibly archaic.
Mm-hmm.
How do churches kind of connect with this message and shift the way they do things?
Well, it's hard. I mean, in some cases, I think what churches have to do is, well, first of all, the leaders have to have this vision. The church can't go anywhere where the leaders are unwilling to go, and this is a huge conflict, source of conflict, of course. You'll have people in the church that get it, but the pastors don't, or something like that. But I think there are several obstacles and that we have to overcome if we're going to take the existing church through this. The first big obstacle is the building. We build these big buildings that are very expensive to own and operate. The utilities are increasingly prohibitive, and we end up putting all of our financial and emotional resources into that building. That becomes the church. And then our idea of mission is that we try to get all those people out there to come into our building, and we want them to contribute financially because it's so expensive with this building. It shapes our whole understanding of church. It's all sucked into this building thing. So the building is a problem. I think about Mosaic, which is a church in Los Angeles. Irwin McManus is the pastor of that church, and they decided to sell their building, which was many decades old, and they sold their building and decided they would decentralize across Los Angeles and form church communities in unlikely places, such as meeting in nightclubs and things like that. And Mosaic has become a very powerful expression of the new expression of church that's a little bit along the lines of what I've written about in the Mystic Way, because they overcame that obstacle of building. Another obstacle has to do with money, of course. So many times in the church, what's happened is, I'll speak from my own tradition, I'm United Methodist. We have in the United Methodist Church requirements, minimum salary requirements for our clergy, which makes perfect sense. And we have very expensive health insurance that churches are required to pay. Again, it makes perfect sense. When you have a job, you need to have health insurance. And then there's the retirement package. Okay, well, what is happening now is that more and more churches in the United Methodist Church cannot afford a full-time pastor, because that means having to pay that minimum salary at least, and pension, and a very expensive health insurance policy. In fact, when I was in East Ohio before I moved to Texas, a new policy came out, which maybe has changed, I don't know, this is just a few years ago, but churches had to pay that health insurance whether their pastor used it or not.
Wow.
So, for example, I was on my husband's health insurance through his work, which meant my church had money to invest in mission in the community. Well, when this policy changed, we had to stop doing mission in the community with that money, and we had to put all that money into the health insurance that I didn't even use. You were required to pay it into the headquarters. So that sort of thing is choking the church. It turns into a situation, whether it's Methodist or some other denomination, where because of the money issue, because pastors are living on the people's offerings, that it can get to the point where the church is all about making sure, me speaking as a pastor, making sure that people put the money in the offering so that I can buy my groceries and put my kids through college. It turns into this thing where instead of church being about mission and love in our community, it's anxiety producing, because how are we going to pay for the pastor's salary and health insurance and things like that? So the whole money issue and a resistance to bivocationality, and that again is tied to the fact that we want large churches. We're not interested in small churches that could be pastored very simply with bivocational pastors.
So this book is published by an academic press. Does that mean the audience are professors and pastors and people in seminary, or do you imagine a bigger audience for this?
Well, it actually is a bigger audience. I'm getting feedback from really diverse people. I tried to write the book in such a way that it would be engaging in current and actually move the conversation forward in my field, which is evangelism. So I wanted to help shape the future discourse in the field of evangelism at an academic level. And I think the book does that. I think that myself, and then I'm getting feedback from colleagues in different institutions that are saying so. But also, I wanted to make the book accessible for lay people as much as possible and make it very interesting for seminary students, a prime audience for me, because I really want to shape how we think about the church and how we think about mission and evangelism for the future. So what I've done, I've tried to use clear, understandable writing. You'll have to tell me if it worked. And when I use theological terms, I explain what they mean right away so that the reader can follow through. Now, I've had several lay people with different levels of education read the book, and they generally said to me, well, I had to use my dictionary a few times, but I'm glad I did. One person said, I've read this book twice, and I'm going to read it a third time. And he's just a lay person, was very engaged with especially the story at the last five chapters. I've put a fiction story, like little installments in each of the last five chapters, and he found that the easiest to connect with, but he wanted to read all of it three times.
Well, and I'm curious about that. I was wondering, what techniques or tools you used as a writer and an academic to shift from writing kind of regular nonfiction where you're describing a process and and telling some history to writing a fictional story. What helped you do that?
Well, that's a great question. I started out writing the book. I knew I wanted it to be in three parts, you know, and I named the parts after the contemplative path: purgation, illumination, and union. And I did not decide to tell a fictitious story until I was two-thirds of the way through writing the book. And I got to that third part, and I was pondering it, and it came to me, why don't you reintroduce the themes and then tell what it would look like with a story? Because we live in a day where narrative theology is the most effective. It works better for most people. We're very story-oriented. That's why we love movies. And narrative theology is not particularly new. It's been around for millennia. But for some reason, now in our culture, it's part of our postmodern culture, the use of narrative theology is increasing. And I thought, I could do this as narrative theology. I will write a simple story that shows what it might look like if the congregation lived in the ways that I'm proposing. So I just did it and thought, well, if this doesn't work, I'm sure my editors will tell me.
That was very courageous.
Yeah.
And they liked it?
They did like it. They did.
Good.
And I sent it around to readers, of course, before I sent it to my editors to get feedback. I think that's a smart thing to do, is have some good critical and loving but honest friends that, you know, that will read your stuff before you send it in.
I think that's a great idea. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, a number of the people who listen to the program have done PhDs or in PhD programs, and maybe you could talk a little bit about how writing a book, even for an academic press, is really different than writing a dissertation.
Oh, sure. Well, when you write your dissertation, you have a specific audience, your committee, that you have to satisfy. And so there are going to be some special things that you do with your dissertation because you know that Dr. So-and-so is going to read that thing and they're concerned about X, Y, and Z. When you're writing for a broader audience, when you're writing for the academy or you're writing for your colleagues in the academy and hopefully students that are going to read your book as a textbook, I think the first thing you have to think about is writing with intellectual rigor. That needs to happen, of course. But you also want to write in a way that's creative and engaging. We've all had to read textbooks that are hopelessly tedious, but we have to wade through them because they're the classic work on whatever it is. But the books that really change our lives are the ones that engage our imagination. And so I think finding ways to be creative and interesting and as clear as possible, as simple. I don't think you have to, you know, a lot of times coming through doctoral programs, students feel like in order to be taken serious in the academy, they have to say things that are unintelligible, you know, like more long words than necessary and really long sentences and things like that. That isn't really true. We can write very good, in my field of theology, we can write very good theology and be clear at the same time. That's what will help your reader.
So did you have any tools for, you know, for testing whether or not your writing was creative and engaging or keeping yourself creative and engaged with the writing?
Yes, I had diverse readers reading my chapters. I do that on everything that I write. So for The Mystic Way, I had a public school administrator with advanced degrees in education but no theological training. I had her read it. I had a person who teaches high school chemistry. I had a person who's a pastor, and I had an engineer, like a layperson who's an engineer,
wow,
read it and give me feedback so that I know it. And they helped me a lot. There were certain times where they said, you need to explain this concept more. Or they would say, I can't believe you actually wrote that.
Meaning it's so bad or it's so good? Or?
Well, it was so surprising to them that I would say something so bluntly.
Okay.
That it was prophetic or challenging. And, you know, those things. So I got good feedback, and I also got helpful corrective feedback from them.
So I notice you've earned your doctorate, you write frequently, you've got all these books coming out, plus you work as a professor and you work as a pastor.
Yeah.
So what writing habits or practices have helped you get all of this done in a lifetime?
Well, I have kept a journal for almost 30 years now, and I write in my journal almost daily. So I have formed the habit of writing daily.
Okay.
Over a long period of time. And I think that's helped me to just feel comfortable with sitting down and writing. I also, how can I say this? I feel inspired to write. I think it's something God has called me to do. And I can feel when, I can feel sort of the movement of the Holy Spirit in me while I'm writing it. When I'm experiencing that, the writing comes pretty easily for me. It just flows out. At other times, I've had to really discipline myself to sit down and write. At times, writing the Mystic Way, I struggled. What I came to realize when I was struggling while writing the Mystic Way, every time I was struggling, it was because I had anxiety about what I was writing. I had anxiety about who would read it, how would they interpret it. And a strange thing happened when I got to the end of the manuscript. I let it rest a little bit, and then I went back and I started reading it, and I deleted everything I wrote when I was anxious. I could just see passages I wrote when I was anxious.
Wow.
And it helped so much. So in terms of writing suggestions or how do I do that, I have regular time that I spend writing. So having, take time once a day or for at least 3 days out of the week, something like that, to work on your project. Have some space where it's quiet and uninterrupted where you can focus. I need big blocks of time for writing. It's hard for me to just write for 15 minutes and go do something else because I have to get my mind into it. And then be mindful about anxiety that you're carrying about the book or who's going to read it, and doing your inner work around that anxiety, attending to your business around that, because we need to be free inside as we're writing.
Well, and I'm curious about that. What did you do to manage that anxiety while you were working?
I prayed. I prayed by myself, and I prayed with trusted spiritual friends. I let them know what my anxieties were, and they prayed for me. And again, I processed it in my journal and through other means of prayer. So a lot of it had to do with relinquishing my anxieties, naming them, and realizing that those were hindrances, and giving them to God, and then receiving the love and strength and empowerment of God in return.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a final tip you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Write from your heart.
That's great.
Write from your heart. I think so many people already have those books inside. They have those articles and poems inside. And to let that flow out and trust what's in your heart.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate this.
You're welcome.
This has been another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You can find a link to Dr. Heath's book at my website, rightnowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.